This week is unlike all previous region. The people of Lebanon have to suffer this bombing. But it must be remembered that when Israel pulled out of southern Lebanon, the Lebanese government, backed by an army of 125,000 strong, was given a certain number of years to get rid of Hezbollah. That army has been compromised by Syrian influence, and nothing was done about the 10,000 to 20,000 Hezbollah fighters in the south of Lebanon. So we see that now, for the first time, the rival terrorist thugs of Hamas and Hezbollah, who had challenged each other for supremacy in the leadership of the Middle East Murder Incorporated, have come together in a united front. They have gone beyond their homicidal bombings and have opened a formal two-front war against Israel. The best intelligence indicates that the reason they did it now was that the theocratic tyranny of Iran and the fascist regime of Syria, with the blessing of the Wahhabi clerics of Saudi Arabia, who had been major funders of Al-Qaeda, pushed them together to use them as a client army to stop any attempt at peace and stability in the region. They are threatened by the nascent growth of democracy in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Palestine, and they fully realize that once that door to freedom is opened, even ever so slightly, it is impossible to shut, and their own imprisoned people's transcendent yearnings for redemptive change will spread like wildfire. That possibility is something that these regimes and murderous gangs cannot countenance. Their goal, openly stated, from bin Laden to Iran's Ahmadinejad to Hamas's Mishal and Haniyeh to Hezbollah's Nasrallah, is Islamic hegemony over the free world. In these killers' minds, Israel, precisely because it is the frontline defender of Western liberalism and freedom, must be destroyed. Israel, this tiny bastion of liberty, is to these Islamo-fascists what Republican Spain was to Hitler. But unlike the Spanish Republicans, Israel will not fall. If the Western world flags in its support for a sister democracy, its own consciences will. Israel understands full well the meaning of carpe diem, seize the day, that precisely at a time of siege, a free people must seize the tide and turn it towards the destruction of the mightiest walls of oppression. To keep faith with the immortal words of Thomas Jefferson, to pledge eternal vigilance against any attempt at tyranny over the mind of man. Canada did it in 1970. During the FLQ crisis, Trudeau didn't hesitate to send in the army. Israel cannot be held to any less of a standard. The invasive aggressions on Israel's national sovereignty, from Kiryat Shmona in the north to Kerem Shalom in the south, were clear violations of international law that permit the use of full retaliatory response by Israel. Canada's own sponsored International Commission on State Sovereignty and Intervention added another dimension to the prevailing international legal doctrine of self-help, namely the responsibility to protect. It permits attacks against any nation that allows violent operations by any group from its own territory against another state. And the host state can be dealt with as if it had participated in them itself. As a free people, Canadians, who had twice the number of servicemen and women in uniform as a proportion of population that America did in both world wars, should be proud of Prime Minister Harper's unwavering support of Israel as a sister democracy, unswerving condemnation of homicide as a tool of policy, and his unyielding determination to remind Canadians of our own proud legacy of engagement in the expansion and defense of freedom. As John Iveson wrote in the National Post this week, Canada has turned and stopped looking like an inept marriage counselor who sympathized with the spouse who tried to burn down the house. It is instructive to note that the Israeli counterattacks against Hamas and Hezbollah escalated on Thursday, July 13th. That day in the Jewish calendar is the fast day of the 17th of Tammuz. It was on that day in the year 70 of the Common Era that the walls of Jerusalem were breached by Roman invaders. Everyone knows the story of the 900 Jewish rebels who fortified themselves on the mountaintop of Masada and killed themselves rather than submit to Roman domination. Today, Israeli tank commanders take their oath on that mountaintop with the pledge that Masada shall never fall again. Hitler and Franco may not have feared La Pasionada singing of No Pasarán, They Shall Not Pass, when the Spanish Republicans challenged the fascists and Nazis. Those European thugs knew that the Republicans were militarily weak, particularly after the slaughter at Guernica. But modern Israel is not weak. This small oasis of the free is no Guernica. And the leaders of today's Islamo-fascist axis should tremble at the coming of Masada's heirs. We'll be back with our first guest in a moment. Montreal, today we're devoting the show to the Middle East war, the Middle East crisis, and the Islamofascist. You can reach 00006, email at iapm.ca. We're proud to welcome our first guest, former CIA Director R. James Woolsey, of the Committee for the Prisoner. And as I've often said, whenever Jim's on the air, whether he likes it or not, this man took out a great deal of the storehouse of reason and sanity out of Washington. Jim Woolsey, I know you're at a conference. I thank you for joining us this morning.
Good to be with you, bro.
Hamas, Hezbollah, old-time enemies coming together. Syria, supposedly secular Ba'athist state, allied with Iran. This morning, we get news that the Indian prime minister says that there are two groups, one funded by the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, taking responsibility for the Mumbai attacks. Is this a last gasp axis of whoever's left because they realize that American policy in the Middle East is going to open up some doors to freedom and they better hit hard in any allies?
I wish it were their last gasp. You had a very interesting.
I don't mean last gasp in terms of weakness. I mean right. a last attempt at some kind of combined strategy.
Well, I don't think it's last, and I don't think it's first. Arafat did a pretty good job of getting aid from as a secular leader, did a pretty good job of getting aid from the Shiite theocracy in Iran. And another analogy to your 1930s analogies and your lead-in, totalitarians have relatively little trouble working together, just as the Hitler-Stalin pact in 39 surprised a lot of people. The fact that you could have Islamist theocratic Shiites, Islamist theocratic Sunnis, and secular totalitarians all working together here shouldn't really be a surprise. It tends to be a surprise to a lot of intellectuals and people who get locked into these ideologies, but these people are ultimately cynical, and they're perfectly willing to get together if they can take on a democracy like Israel or us.
And indeed, I will never forget your formulation in an institute conference you spoke at where you called the present struggle World War IV, having used Elliot Cohn's formulation of World War III being the Cold War, and you said this is going to be long and this is going to be hard and this is going to be difficult until we see the face of an enemy, even in outlines. Are we seeing an outline of a face of an axis?
Well, it's at least one for the time being, and I think the heart of the matter right now is Iran. Iran has the money because oil is up. Iran has a new president, Ahmadinejad, who is a real fanatic, in league with the most fanatic group within the mullahs in Iran, a man called Mezbah Yazdi, who runs a school in Qom and was exiled there by Khomeini back in the late 70s because he was too radical. This is Ahmadinejad's
mentor. This is a guy who was too radical for Khomeini.
Right.
Great.
So we have in Iran now just an extraordinarily serious situation. Their drive for nuclear weapons, their fanaticism of the leadership, and all the rest, and they ultimately have the money and the population and the rest to be the drivers of what's going on now in Syria and with Hamas and with Hezbollah. It's not accidental, as the saying goes, that these tactics of Hamas and Hezbollah are similar, kidnapping Israeli soldiers by tunneling underneath, shelling with rockets from afar, and looks like some of the rockets and missiles supplied by Iranian technology and by Iran. This is not a uncoordinated group of fanatics.
That's an important point. There has been some talk that Hezbollah, at the beginning of the Hamas attacks on Israel, the state-to-state aggression, let's call it for a moment, had no intention of getting into this until there's a story going around that Khaled Mishal asked the Iranians to ask the Hezbollah to open a second front. Have you heard anything about that?
No, that's news to me, but I'm really out here in Colorado at a conference just following the newspapers occasionally, so I don't know. But I do think that you can't go wrong in this if you assume that Iran is pulling a lot of the strings. Now, in terms of what they are ready and willing to do, Hezbollah and Hamas are both fanatic terrorist, anti-Semitic, totalitarian organizations, and they're perfectly willing, if the word comes from the folks who pay a lot of their salaries, the Iranians, to move in a certain way. They'll move in a certain way, but they're certainly not struggling against it. This is their propensity anyway.
Jim Woolsey, I know you're waiting to take a plane. One last question. President Bush has been unequivocal in support and understanding that this is a state aggression against Israel, and it has the right to defend itself. Canada, for the first time under Prime Minister Stephen Harper, has been just as unequivocal. Are we in a new dimension of American and Canadian relations? And I don't mean the mushy left's complaint about Harper cushing up to Bush. I mean, Is there a realization that we, Canada, now has a government that realizes its place with its traditional allies in the expansion of democratic development in the world?
Well, I hope so. It's no secret that there have been substantial tensions off and on over the last few years. If you look back over the 20th century, Canada, U.S., U.K., and Australia were the four permanent members
right.
of the coalition that defeated Imperial Germany, the Nazis, the Italian fascists, the Japanese imperialists, and the Soviets in the Cold War. And we've had our fallings out here and there a little bit on one thing and another, but it's good to stay in harness, and we're most appreciative for the Prime Minister's position.
Jim Woolsey, many thanks.
Thank you.
Best of luck to you. Montreal, we'll be right back. I've offered Israel's Consul General in Montreal, Mark Attali, the right man at the right place at the right time. He's explanations and interviews in four different languages all week long. Attali, for joining us on Sunday, which should have been a day of rest, but I know that you're in constant contact with the Middle East.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for being on your show, Bill.
My pleasure. Mark, you just heard Jim Woolsey placed a great deal of emphasis during his talk in strategic places in his talk on Iran's role. Now, here, this conflict started out with Hamas, who's been given every opportunity to show that it can govern an independent political jurisdiction. And its response, of course, has been 1,000 Qassam rocket attacks, which Israel took as body blows. Finally, they breached Israeli sovereignty. And, of course, that is an act of war. But Hezbollah's coming in there. Was that a surprise to anybody? Could that, because Hamas and Hezbollah normally aren't that close. Was this a result of anything that Khaled Mishal, Hamas's political director in Damascus, could have done with Iran's complicity and Iran intervening with Hezbollah? Because Woolsey mentioned many times that Iran is the player we got to watch out for in terms of controlling all these groups.
Well, first of all, the connection between Hezbollah and Hamas is not a secret. We all know that for a long time now, Hezbollah is being very active also among Hamas and the Palestinian territories. However, what is important to note is that Hamas and Hezbollah are driven by an extremist jihadist ideology, which calls for the immediate destruction of the State of Israel, and that's as a part of an international effort of, the holy war against the infidel Western world.
What Amir Tahrir called holy terror.
Well, holy terror, yes, if you want. And in this regard, we are talking about two radical terrorist organizations that in the name of Islam, they basically are leading a war against the State of Israel, but not only against the State of Israel. Now, on top of that, when we are talking about Syria and Iran, I mean, those two countries support those two groups. When it comes to Hezbollah, it's very clear, and it was always clear, and Israel keep insisted on that for years now, that Iran and Syria are behind the armament of Hezbollah.
No, Ahmadinejad happily takes credit for that.
Absolutely, he does not deny it, because Syria and Iran...
We don't hear enough of that in the media, but they take credit for that.
They support those groups, not only because they support their ideology, they also, for them, it's an opportunity, let's say, to reject the pressure that has been imposed on both countries by the international community. So they're trying to also to divert the attention. However, when it comes to Hezbollah, just to mention that the missile that was shot against an Israeli warship 2 days ago, show that Hezbollah, it's not just another terrorist guerrilla organization, another small organization. This is an organization with the military power that is being armed by Syria and Iran with missiles and sophisticated weapon system that you don't even find in other armies, sophisticated army in the world. And this is what is amazing about the situation. The long-range missiles that were launched against Haifa this morning, where do you think they get this technology and those missiles? Everything is very clear today that who is behind that. And Hezbollah, in fact, is serving the interests of Syria that is controlling Lebanon, and Iran, who, by the way, the only way where they succeeded with their Iranian revolution, paradoxically or ironically, it is southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, and Hezbollah, which is a part of a legitimate government of Lebanon. This is what is absurd in all this.
With 20% of the parliament and two ministers.
Absolutely.
Mark Attali, we have to go to news. Do you have time to stay with us for a few more minutes after the news?
Yes.
Thank you. Montreal, I'll be right back. We're back, Montreal, and every World Wide Web. We're devoting this show to the conflict in the Middle East, State of the Free. Our guest right now is Israeli Consul General Mark Attali. In our last segment, you were beginning to talk about Lebanon and Hezbollah, and I think a lot of people don't understand what you started to say. Hezbollah is not just, as you said, a terrorist organization. They have sophisticated weapons supplied by Iran. They're 20% of the Lebanese parliament, and the Lebanese government had been given years by the United Nations after the Israeli pullout to get rid of Hezbollah from the south, and they failed.
Yes,
why is this not out front in the media? Look, everybody seems to think this came out of nowhere. This is not from yesterday.
Look, I mean, first of all, those are old news, and I'm fortunately, as you said, it's not a way yet too much emphasized on the media, and this is unfortunate, because look, when Israel withdrew from Lebanon in the year 2000, it has the approval of the UN. We respected the UN resolution that on this regard, and we went back to the international border. The Lebanese government had the chance to impose its sovereignty on the southern part of Lebanon and to fulfill the UN resolution 1559, and it didn't do it.
And Syria openly wouldn't let them do it.
The Lebanese government did not take this initiative. The Syrians kept controlling Lebanon, keep arming Hezbollah, and we finally, I would say, in a situation that while Israel fulfilled all of its obligations according to the UN resolution, nothing was done from the Lebanese part.
One could almost call the attacks against northern Israel from Lebanon a double state aggression, combining Syria supporting Hezbollah and Lebanon not exercising its national sovereignty, an act of omission almost as critical as an act of commission.
Yes, in fact, the fact that it's the attack came from the territory of a sovereign country against another sovereign country, it's definitely an act of war, and this is what Israel finds itself in. And what Israel is doing, basically, and this is something that it's important also to emphasize, we are not doing anything which is in contradiction with the UN Resolution 1559 that calls for the dismantling and the destroying of the Hezbollah organization and infrastructure. The problem is that we find ourselves again on the front line of this war against terrorism. While there is a widening consensus in the international community that Jihadist terror became a global threat, and we expect the international community to fulfill also its role in this regard.
And indeed, our next guest, Professor Nadav Malapat from India, will be talking just about that, because there are now two jihadist groups claiming credit for the Mumbai bombings, both claiming financial support from the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, so you see, it's a threat that not only Israel faces. However, what we are facing these days, it's an immediate threat, an immediate war that will launch against Israel. And what Israel basically is doing is protecting itself. I think it's the obligation of every democratic state to do the same thing that Israel is doing. And we are not, and again, also there is something that I want to it's important for me to mention. The paradox and the tragedy of Lebanon and the Lebanese people, that for years they are being the hostages of the Hezbollah. And if you, I may, I can quote you the two declaration of two Lebanese ministers just 2-3 days ago. Mr. Marwan Hamouda, he was saying, and I quote, Damascus gives the orders, Iran supplies the equipment, Israel reacts, and Lebanon is the victim. Another minister, Lebanese minister, who said the Hezbollah has not only kidnapped two Israeli soldiers, it has taken the whole Lebanon hostage. And this is the situation that unfortunately the Lebanese find themselves again. After 30 years of war, they find again the same in the situation they find themselves also 30 years ago. You know something, Bill? I was listening to the Israeli general talking about further bombing in southern Lebanon. Let me tell you something. Hezbollah, first of all, we are targeting the infrastructure of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, in Beirut, and elsewhere. But did you know, and I'm definitely sure that it's a known fact, but I will insist on that, Hezbollah used to pay monthly salaries to families in southern Lebanon and elsewhere in Lebanon in order to hide in their homes missiles. And the fact that you are bombing in southern Lebanon, as the general declared, and we are calling the population...
In fact, they have found Katusha rocket launchers in the backyards of homes and villages throughout southern Lebanon.
Yeah, and the fact that we are sending leaflets and we are warning the population, please evacuate the area, not because we want to hit the population. We are targeting those facilities that, unfortunately, they are within the civilian population, because cynically, for years, Hezbollah is using the Lebanese people as a human shield. I keep repeating, we are not in a war against the Lebanese people, but we ask the government of Lebanon to demonstrate its determination to fulfill its obligation according to the UN resolution. And the second, we are determined to fight Hezbollah until peace will come back to the northern parts of Israel. It's absurd. No country in the world will accept a situation in which one-third of its population, one-third of the Israeli population today is under the threat of a blind attack of Hezbollah missiles on the population of Israel.
I wonder how Montrealers would react if missiles were launched constantly against either the West Island or the eastern part of the island of the city.
Well, I guess the declaration of Prime Minister Stephen Harper sent a very strong signal that when it comes to terrorism, there should be no compromises.
Zero tolerance. Consul General Mark Attali of Israel, we wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. Montreal, we'll be right back. While racists, civilized world, and are on the other brand of hate crime flourishes undisturbed, even in countries that are allies of the West. This is religious supremacy, the belief that those practicing a particular faith have the same, quote, right to discriminate against others in the same way as racial supremacists regard as their God-given privilege to consign the rest to a permanently inferior status. The Islamist and jihadist admiration for Nazis is hardly an accident, as the two beliefs have much in common, including the notion of superiority over oneself and the worthless or non-human status of all others. The man who wrote those stirring words is joining us right now. We've been through Washington with Jim Woolsey to Montreal with the Israeli Consul General. We now go to New Delhi, and we're honored to be joined by Professor Madhav Dasnalapat. He's director of the School of Geopolitics at the Manipal Academy of Higher Education in New Delhi and has been credited by many as authoring the American-Indian Nuclear Cooperation Agreement, and authoring other agreements of cooperation between the India, Israel, and the United States, almost building an alliance of democracies. Professor Nalapat, welcome and thank you for joining us today. I know it's very late in India.
Thank you, Beryl.
Professor Nalapat, we've received news today that there are now something like two organizations who are claiming credit from the Mumbai attacks. And one of them is crediting Wahhabi funding. Now, you have written a great deal about the role of the Wahhabis and their new appeasement. As a matter of fact, Professor Nalapat's article on that will be appearing in the Institute's magazine Barricades. It hits its stands tomorrow. Between the attacks on Israel, the attacks in Mumbai, are we seeing some kind of a concerted effort, a concerted access between the client armies of Hamas, Hezbollah, the funders from Iran and the Wahhabis against any democracy, be it Israel or India or anything in between?
Well, Beryl, what is very worrying actually is the fact that the Wahhabis used to regard the Shia as being kafir, that is unbelievers. And if you'll read Wahhabi literature, it's extremely anti-Shia, it's extremely anti-Sufi. But then along came...
We should explain to our listeners that the Sufis are Muslim mystics. The Shias represent many insurgent groups. So there's the Shia, the Sunni, and the Sufi divisions within Islam.
Well, the fact is that the Shia are a very major force in Islam, and they are the majority in Iraq, and they, of course, are the overwhelming majority in Iran. Now, till now, the Wahhabis have always abused the Shia, even today. But unfortunately, when Imam Khomeini came along, he turned Shia doctrine on its head and started a policy of trying to be friendly with the Wahhabis. And today, that the same thing is being carried on by Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, Khamenei has completely forgotten the fact that the Wahhabis are completely opposed to anything that Shia Islam stands for, and Khamenei has now reached out and is grasping the Wahhabis. So today we have two very dangerous forces.
Now, just to clarify for our listeners again, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Professor. The Wahhabi clerical establishment in Saudi Arabia basically controls education, interior ministry, even the police in some areas, while the Saudi royal family are left with business. And That is the strength that the Wahhabis have, and in fact, the Wahhabis are major funders of Al-Qaeda. Please continue.
Well, you're perfectly right. And this is therefore the most dangerous thing, that is these two fanatic tendencies, that is Wahhabism and Khomeinism, have now become partners in this war against democracy. Now, I'd like to say very clearly that I think we should de-link Islam from this, because the Wahhabis are not Muslims. And in my view, it is very dangerous to consider them Muslim, because they are sheltering behind Islam and trying to fool the Muslim community into believing that they are in fact representing them. The fact is, Wahhabism is completely antithetical to Islam, just as Khomeinism is completely antithetical to Shia Islam. So Sunni Islam and Wahhabism are opposites of each other. Shia Islam and Khomeinism are opposites of each other. Unfortunately, today in the world, Shia Islam is now represented by the Khomeinists, and Wahhabi Islam is now representing the Sunnis. So these two pretenders have now taken control of these two great branches of the Muslim faith.
Professor Nalapat, we just got to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you. Firmly, we're taking a look at the Alliance of Democracy today, and those who realize the Middle East conflict is not just an attack on a state, but on a free way of life. We're honored to be have as our guest right now, Professor Nadav Nalapat, Director of Geopolitics at the Manipal Academy in New Delhi. Professor Nalapat, you said in our earlier segment how the Wahhabis and how the Khomeini Shias in Iran have hijacked Islam, or elements of Islam. Have they also hijacked governments? We have today, of course, Prime Minister Singh of India accusing Pakistan of being under the control of their own brand of Islamic terrorists behind the Mumbai bombings. And if they are in control of governments, what is the appropriate way of response?
Well, I'd like to say, Beryl, that the problem started in the 1970s when petrodollars started flowing into Saudi Arabia. And as a result, the Saudi Wahhabis started funding institutions worldwide. Till that time, 90% of the Muslim organizations were anti-Wahhabi. But unfortunately, since the 1970s, because of Saudi money, and now because of petrodollars and Iranian money, about 90% of Muslim organizations, unfortunately, are under the grip of either the Wahhabis or the Khomeinists. I can put it in context by saying that Christians have a fanatic fringe, Jews have a fanatic fringe, Hindus have a fanatic fringe. Of course, the difference is that these fanatic fringes don't resort to terrorism. They don't resort to organized violence the way the Wahhabis and the Khomeinists do. But assume that the Christians, Jews, and Hindus of the world would then, in a sense, be following this fanatic fringe. This is the tragedy that has befallen the Muslim community in the world. The entire community has now been in a situation where it is just meekly following these two horrible monsters, Wahhabism and Khomeinism.
Professor Nalapat, we have Isaac on the line who has a question for you. Isaac, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Beryl. So, Professor Nalapat, I think you've got some very interesting concepts, and I'm sure you've done a lot of work on this. I have a question for you. It looks like India has just woken up. I mean, in the sense that now the Prime Minister of India has made a statement about the involvement of Pakistan. The issue is, will India actually take action, or will it wait for a few more attacks to take place?
Well, I'm afraid, Isaac, that India is very different from Israel. The reality is that the successive governments in India have been extremely soft in dealing with terrorism.
Correct.
Take, for example, what happened in Kandahar. You know, at the turn of the, when the new millennium started, there was the hijack of an Indian Airlines aircraft, and hardened terrorists were released, some of whom were involved in the planning for 9/11. So, unfortunately, the government of India has always responded in a very weak way, and thus far we have heard nothing but words from Dr. Singh, whereas in the case of Israel, it's less words and more action.
Right. The issue is...
Isaac, we're fighting the clock. I'd love to continue
okay, go
this.
Ahead. Go ahead.
We're fighting the clock, and I got to thank you for your question, and Professor Nalapat, I have to thank you for coming on the show. Once again, Professor Madhav Das Nalapat, Director of the School of Geopolitics at the Manipal Academy, Wahhabism and the new appeasement in this month's issue of Barricades, the Institute magazine, which is hitting the stands tomorrow, and the August issue will have another article by Professor Nalapat called Defeating Religious Supremacy. And Isaac, I apologize for cutting you short and Professor Nalapat short, but I hope a lot of answers will be questions will be answered in those articles as well as what Professor Nalapat has shared with us today. Thank you both. Montreal will be right back with you after the news. From Washington to New Delhi, we've been talking with leading experts in the world who are analyzing the current crisis in the Middle East, the war in the Middle East. It's now a war on Western liberalism and freedom, and we'll be continuing and bringing the conversation back home to Ottawa and Toronto in just a moment. But first, we'd like to say hello to Carl. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Barron.
How are you?
I'm fine, but without posing any judgment, I'm questioning myself because I'm not an army strategist, let alone a commander of an army. Wondering somewhere if there was another way out to catch those scums of Ebola without posing more injuries to maybe some tourists and civilians.
Well, you know, everybody's concerned about that, and you heard the Israeli consul general talk about strategic bombing. Now, I think it's important, and you bring up an important point.
Yeah, just question. I only have a question in my mind.
We all know that at least half of the Lebanese people who have just entered a democratic phase in their history, who have just liberated parts of themselves from Syria, have at least as much of a understanding of the Israeli position as anything else.
Exactly.
The Israeli bombing of Beirut has been strategic. They've attacked Sheikh Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader's headquarters. Mm-hmm. There have been, unfortunately, 70 deaths and 130 injured, but these have been strategic bombings in Beirut. And as sad as they are, besides knocking out the Hezbollah infrastructure, the military infrastructure in the south, they've got to knock out the headquarters within Beirut because the Lebanese government couldn't do it. At the same time, our listeners should be reminded that Israel itself has suffered over 50 civilian deaths and hundreds of injuries, and they've taken 600 Katyusha rocket attacks. There are 1 million Israelis in shelters right now, 1 million, a sixth of the country. Imagine if a sixth of Quebec was hiding in shelters. So it's an unfortunate situation, but this is a war for freedom, and it's Israel happens to be the first nation, the frontline nation in it.
And I'm wondering also, the civilians that were there, and even tourists, because I had among my teacher, a math teacher, he was Lebanese of Christian faith, I have to mention it, there's no way of knowing if because he used to go every year to visit in Beirut, his
right.
family. I just hope and pray that he wasn't there and he didn't die because he's a good man.
Well, I can tell you that my wife's closest friends are Palestinian Muslims with a great deal of family in Beirut, and they're on the phone all the time. And my wife is fluent in Hebrew and Arabic, so it's a question that hits home to all of us. It is not a question of the Lebanese people. It's a question of Hezbollah, a foreign element imposed on Lebanon, just as when Jordan kicked out the PLO in Black September in 1970, and they flooded southern Lebanon. This was not a fault of the Lebanese people, and the Syrians backed them again. And we can only hope that this doesn't expand. We know it's going to be very interesting to watch today as the United States is sending soldiers in to take out Americans. Whether the American soldiers will be attacked as they escort American civilians out of Beirut, that will be something to watch today.
Yeah.
But so far there has been no reports of foreigners or visitors who've been injured in the bombings, but certainly it's an unfortunate situation and they have trouble getting out.
Yeah,
so we'll all be watching.
Everybody. They have to really evacuate everybody. That's, my God, and even the ones who live there.
You're quite right. And we'll all be watching, and I don't think any of us will forget the pictures on the covers of Time and Newsweek of the Lebanese celebrating their democracies and what they thought earlier this year was going to be freedom from the iron grip of the Syrians and the Iranians who have been backing Hezbollah.
Yeah,
and as
you know
Ambassador
what?
Dan Gillerman, the Israeli ambassador, said in the United Nations yesterday, he pointed at the Lebanese ambassador and he said, you know that what we're doing by destroying Hezbollah will help Lebanon more than any other country. So we'll stand by and keep a close look on this. Thank you, Carol. We'll be right back. Montreal, we're talking about the Middle East at war. Indeed, the free world at war with an insidious philosophy and an insidious nations, those gangs. Many of us have been frustrated over the years by Canadian policy. Once again, to quote John Iveson writing in the National Post, Canada was often left looking like an inept marriage counselor sympathizing with the spouse who tried to burn down the house when it came to Middle East policy. We can't forget former Prime Minister Martin's visit to Libya, where he called Muammar Gaddafi the butcher of Lockerbie, where Canadians died on that Pan Am flight, a man with a philosophical bent of mind. But there are Canadians who won't sit still for political correctness. There are Canadians who understand that social justice does not end at our borders. There are Canadians who understand that we must be involved with mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change. And we have two of these very special people with us now, living embodiments of what Emerson once wrote. One man, resolute, abiding by the truth, shall rally a majority. We're now very pleased to have with us two such men. Alistair Gordon is chair of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. Their task has been to get the Canadian government more involved, more engaged in democratic development in the world. David Harris, president of Insignis Research and former chief of strategic planning for CSIS, has had the worst elements of Islamists on his back and not only survived but thrived. We welcome you both, Alistair and David. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Beryl. Thank you, Beryl.
Alistair, my first question has to go to you. You've got to be happy with a prime minister who says Hamas is democratically elected, not legitimate until it renounces violence, who says in Kandahar, Canadians do not cut and run, who orders and demands the arrest of Saeed Mortazavi, the Iranian prosecutor who beat to death with a shoe Sarah Kajimi, the Montreal photojournalist in Tehran, and who has been unequivocal in his support for a democratic state's right to protect itself. This has got to be a validation and a culmination of a lot of the work that the Canadian Coalition for Democracies does.
Well, you're absolutely right, Beryl. I think it's the first time in many, many years that Canadians are actually taking a position on conflicts in which democracies are being challenged by tyrannies. I was particularly pleased that Stephen Harper didn't fall into the trap of equating the Israeli military operation to a simple kidnapping. He was very clear that Israel is defending its right to exist as a nation, not merely to resolve a kidnapping with this military operation. And I think anybody capable of analyzing the situation in the Middle East must realize that this isn't a result of a kidnapping. This is a result
of a breach of national sovereignty, and he got it.
Well, yeah, it's a result of decades of terrorist attacks launched by extraterritorial entities against Israel.
Well, you have been one of the most eloquent voices across the country on this, and this ripple effect, I think, that you and your organization have caused is important, and it had something to do with this besides Prime Minister Harper's own principles.
Well, I think a lot of it is Prime Minister Harper's principles. I mean, I think under the last government, we were able to be an irritant, and we were able to open a few eyes to the fact that Canada's foreign policy was perhaps the cause of death and suffering in the world, not a resolution of it. But really, I think it's the moral compass of Stephen Harper and Stockwell Day and Peter McKay and Gordon O'Connor and others within this party that we're seeing reflected in the new foreign policy, which will continue to press and to analyze and to point out where it's not exactly going in the right direction. But it is most definitely the difference between day and night compared to the fog that this country has lived in terms of foreign policy for the last 13 years.
David Harris in Ottawa, you have a perhaps singularly unique knowledge of the men in the shadows behind the frontline organizations that call themselves the people's armies, the people's representatives. You survived the legal challenge from the Canadian American Israel the Canadian American Islamic Relations Council. You have singular knowledge of what's behind these groups, Hamas and Hezbollah. Are you at all surprised by their joint venture, if you like, in this fighting? And what can you tell us about the Iranian-Syrian connection backing them and the Wahhabi money backing those?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Hezbollah and Hamas, before being obvious enemies of Israel, are, of course, enemies of Canada, and they've been defined as such through their inclusion in the list of proscribed, of banned terrorist organizations under Canadian criminal law. And there's no mistake or mere coincidence to that inclusion. We've seen these organizations as rabid, racist, Islamic supremacist organizations. And when you look, as I think you've done frequently enough, at things like the Hamas Charter, your skin will crawl as you see in what purports to be a constitutional document, the constitution of the party that is actually running the Palestinian territories, references to the need to kill Jews, to really demonize them, and of course various other pathological approaches associated with the raw fanaticism we've seen in jurisdictions like Iran and Syria, for that matter.
David, hold that thought. We've got to pay a bill. I want to speak to you specifically about Section 7 of their charter. Montreal, will be right back. Gordon and the Canadian Coalition for Seas, David Ottawa, former Chief of Strategic Planning for CSIS, two of the few voices of clarity and courage on where Canadian foreign policy should be going. David, we left you when you were discussing, I believe it was Article 7 of the Hamas Charter.
Yes, that's a choice piece.
By the way, in the meantime, we got two emails, one for each of you, so I'll let you finish, and then we'll get to the questions.
Okay, yeah, I mean, built into the charter, imagine the equivalent appearing in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada. Well, here's the excerpt from the Charter, Section 7 of Hamas. It says, the prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, the time will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews and kill them, until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, oh, Muslim, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come on and kill him. And it goes on.
You mean you Christians are left out, you poor things?
Well, you know, the difficult thing is, how on earth do you negotiate or hope to come to terms with groups of this inclination? I mean, this is the essence of bigotry, rabid racism, and terrorism. And unfortunately, of course, these groups, as we know, Hezbollah and Hamas, are backed profoundly by Iran and Syria, and becoming all the more frightening for that.
Well, David, I'm going to use you as a segue. I hope you, and I know you won't mind, because one of the emails came in for Al Gordon, and what you've been reading is not just racism. It's almost doctrinaire fascism that the Nazis used based on race superiority. And Al Gordon, we had an email question for you that, excuse me, how do we make Western free peoples understand that this is not just about religion? It's not just about a state faith organizations trying to impose their will on the free world, but the methodology of their imposition is basically on the fascist model.
Well, I think one way to get the message across is to point out the fact that what is happening between Hezbollah, Hamas, and Israel is not just some regional conflict, any more than the beheading of Christian schoolgirls in the Philippines is a regional conflict, or the slaughter of farmers in Thailand, or the blowing up of Egyptians in the Sinai. These are not independent regional conflicts. They are the same conflicts which probably came close to slaughtering thousands of Torontonians should the plans of those 17 have been allowed to come to fruition. So I think one way to get the message across that these are not disconnected regional conflicts, but it's a conflict that has targeted Canada and may soon succeed in committing the kinds of atrocities in Canada that we see that same movement committing around the world.
Al, that was an email for you from Isaac. David, we have another email for you from Sam, who asked this question, which is more tactically and military. Is this going to be, his fear is, he understands the necessity of the fight, but his fear is a ground attack inside Lebanon by Israeli forces, which could amount to grave injuries and deaths. Is there a way that this can be accomplished through an air war? The destruction of the Hezbollah and Hamas infrastructures.
It's not altogether clear, Beryl. One of the most distinctive aspects of this Israeli campaign is the extreme care that is being applied to the targeting and the carrying out of missions. Although to many of us, of course, the loss of so many individual citizens in Lebanon, not to mention, of course, the great number in Israel, is regrettable. Given the firepower involved, it is almost miraculous to think that the Israelis have achieved as few injuries in Lebanon as they have. But that still leaves us, of course, with the issue, what kind of cordon sanitaire, what kind of security corridor can the Israelis be able to bring into existence in southern Lebanon so as to bar the Hezbollah from yet again using as a missile base that territory against
600 rockets so far.
Well, this is it, and they've been subjected in Israel to thousands of these things. It's the only neck of the woods, surely, where a truce can be talked about as something that exists when thousands of rockets are falling on you.
Alistair Gordon, David Harris, you make us proud to be Canadians, and you're leading us into a new dimension and a new dynamic in this country, and we thank you for joining us today.
Thanks Beryl.
Take care. Montreal, we'll be right back. Today to this and the war for freedom that is going on in the Middle East today. You can reach us at by email at info@iapm.ca, and we've got Don from Montreal on the line. Hello, Don.
Yes, Mr. Barry, how you doing?
Fine.
Yes, I just may ask you a question.
Certainly.
Metaphorically speaking, is it good for Israel to gain the whole world and lose its own soul?
Israel's soul is not going to be lost by fighting for freedom for the Western world against a fascist philosophy that wants us to live under their dictates. Thank you for your call, Don. Now, Montreal, we've gone through New Delhi. We've gone through Washington. We've gone through Ottawa and Toronto. And now we're going to Los Angeles and welcome a very special guest, Nani Darwish, board member of Arabs for Israel, author of Now They Call Me Infidel, Why I Rejected Jihad for America. It's available on Amazon.com, and we're proud to welcome Nani with us. She's been with us before. Nani Darwish, how are you?
Hi, Beryl. My pleasure.
Nani, with you, I'd like to discuss something. This war that's broken out, mm-hmm. it's had a different reaction from previous wars. I may be wrong, and you certainly have a better feeling for the pulse of the Arab street on this, but are more and more Arab nations, Arab communities, Arab Muslim communities, understanding that this time Iran and Syria and Hezbollah and Hamas may have gone too far? And is there more of an understanding of what is going on in this conflict than in previous conflicts?
This is the first time I see the Muslim world and the Arab world not exactly having the reaction that usually happens after an attack. Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, in a very diplomatic way, are not supporting Hezbollah in their actions.
Saudi Arabia actually came out with a understated statement, but still a statement of condemnation of Hezbollah, saying that their actions were irresponsible.
Totally irresponsible, and
that's a first, I think, for Saudi Arabia.
Yes. That's the world now sees the truth as it is. And the truth is, the only place that did not hit Israel was the West Bank, which is still the occupied by Israel. And that it makes it very clear. The excuse of occupation has been exposed as just an excuse. Here are the two areas that Israel has evacuated, are engaging in attacks on Israel. What does the Israeli government do?
And that's a question that's been asked not only in Israel but everywhere. Israel withdrew from Gaza. Israel took 1,000 Qassam rocket attack blows. Israel is building the land bridge between Gaza and the West Bank. 700,000 Palestinians work in Israel. As bad as occupation is generally, the West Bank has the lowest infant mortality, the best medical care, and the highest rate of college-educated young people of all frontline Arab states. Nobody knows what more they want other than just the imposition of a fascist philosophy. That's the only thing anybody can figure out.
And as a matter of fact, I see that the world really is silently supporting Israel. A lot of countries are silently and cheering for Israel. And this has
Nani, hold that thought because I want to explore that with you. We just got to pay a bill. We'll be right back with you. Board member of Arabs for Israel, you've in our previous segment that the support for Israel's situation and indeed the free world situation right now. Now, you have written in your new book that will be out in November 2006. I recommend everybody go to Amazon.com and check it out. Now They Call Me Infidel, Why I Rejected Jihad for America. You wrote that a religion is judged by the behavior of the people who practice it. It is up to the Muslim Arab people to seek either international respect or remain with international fear of their religion. Where is the Arab Muslim world moving now? You're from Egypt, and we know that President Mubarak has had a great deal of trouble with the Islamic Brotherhood the past year and a half. He's jailed 26,000 of them. How is his support on the street?
The problem with the whole Middle East and Islamic and Arab countries is the governments don't have total control over the radical groups. They have, in the last 50 years, created a monster with their education, with their hatred, with the indoctrination of several generations. And now they are faced with this abundance of radicals in all these countries. And governments have created it, really, but now they have no control over it.
Nani, I want to bring in somebody who may... I think may share some of your views and may shed some light on it. Uniquely, I'm sorry, I'm just getting signals. We had a technical break, Nani. We were going to bring in a journalist who's traveled throughout the Arab world. What do you think the Arab governments have to do?
They have to immediately change their educational system. This is very important. It's not going to be easy for them. After years of creating radical Muslims, you can't just change the switch and say, now we have to be compassionate to our neighbors, the Jews. No, it's very hard.
Does that mean control over the madrasas, the religious schools?
Exactly. They have to start teaching how to live with the rest of the world, with the rest of the non-Muslim world.
Nani, we're now being joined. The technical glitches have been worked out. The gremlins are gone. And we're being joined by a very special guest, our friend Ron Ben-Ishai, senior foreign correspondent of Yediot Ahronot, Israel's biggest newspaper, and the first Israeli journalist to broadcast from Baghdad. Ron, welcome.
Hi, Baron.
Thank you for taking the time. Ron, you're on the line with myself, of course, and Nani Darwish, who's a board member of Arabs for Israel from Los Angeles. And she's making the point that she feels that there is a silent majority out there, even in the Arab world and certainly in Arab communities abroad, who for the first time are getting it. They're understanding that this time they've gone too far, that the Arab states have gone too far, that Iran has gone too far, that the Wahhabis have gone too far, that Hezbollah has gone too far. And among her suggestions is that the first thing that the Arab states have to do, even Mubarak's Egypt, is take control of the educational system. Now, do you feel, first of all, you're incredibly well-traveled, perhaps singularly unique as far as travel in the Arab states, do you feel that there is a silent majority of Arabs who now understand the necessity for this operation?
I'm not so sure to what extent it is a majority, but definitely it is silent. And the problem is that most of the Arab world, as a matter of fact, the whole Arab world, is not democratic. And therefore, silent majority, this term has no meaning when you are talking about influencing the Arab governments. But at the same token, I think it is a mistake to put all Arab countries in the same basket in this regard. Because Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, for instance, just to name...
Well, we were talking about that before with Nani, who's an Egyptian. How significant is it? It was significant to her. How significant do you take the Saudi Arabian sub rosa condemnation of Hezbollah?
I take it is very significant. And as a matter of fact, Saudi Arabia is playing right now a very active role in an attempt to solve the crisis in a way that can also satisfy Israel's demand.
This is, question can be open to both of you. Is it because the Saudi royal family itself is now afraid of the Wahhabi clerical establishment? Do they find that the Wahhabis are out of control?
I think, yes. Definitely they have been suffering from the radical groups in Saudi Arabia. And they also want to prove to the world that they are not, after 9/11, that they are not the promoters of terrorism, and they're against the terror actions around the world. So this is a good opportunity for Saudi Arabia to prove, to reform its image.
Ron Benishai, what say you? What's the reason for
victory? A victory of the Hezbollah means a victory of Iran. And Saudi Arabia is afraid, first and foremost, of the Arab radicalism that is.
Does it also mean the victory of the Wahhabis? You heard, and Professor Madhav Nalapat made the point earlier in the program that that the Wahhabis are out of the mainstream and have their own agenda. So, are the Saudi's royal family afraid that a victory for Hezbollah and for Iran will also mean further Wahhabi control over Saudi Arabia?
To some extent, but let me remind you, there is a thing that when we are talking in the context of this crisis, of the current crisis, is that 11% of the Saudi population are Shiite, like the Hezbollah, like Iran. And if there is a major victory for Hezbollah in this crisis, the Shiites in Saudi Arabia that were fermenting for a long time might threaten the Saudi Arabia oil field. They are sitting, most of the Shiites are sitting in the northern eastern part of Saudi Arabia where the rich oil fields are.
So you've got a Saudi government that's afraid for money. Ron,
not only money, but control of Saudi Arabia.
I understand that, Ronnie and Nani. If you would just be patient with us, we've got to pay a bill because my producer is about to kill me. So we'll be right back after this. IEP was in Jerusalem from Los Angeles. Nani Darwish, board member of Arabs for Israel. Ron Benishai, senior foreign correspondent of Yediot Ahronot. Ron, I just want you to finish your point that you were making on Saudi Arabia and its fears for its oil and for its money and for its power.
Everything that destabilized the region, everything, is threatening Saudi Arabia and the Saudi regime. So no wonder that they are trying to pacify and to quell the fire before it gets out of hand in Arab terms, and before more and more, before, for instance, Iran tries to help the Hezbollah, which is also a possibility. So this is very clear, and I would say that the Saudi Arabia is playing a positive role in the current situation, in trying to pacify and to find a way out of the crisis.
Ron Benishai from Jerusalem, Nani Darwish from Los Angeles, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We welcome now a man with a singular knowledge of what Israel needs to do now going forward. David Harel was former Director of International Affairs for the Israeli Security Agency. David, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Good afternoon.
I think you're putting the cherry on the cake of this whole discussion that has taken us from New Delhi to Washington through Los Angeles to Jerusalem. We've talked about the strategic situation, the tactical situation, the military, the economic. You have intimate knowledge of what needs to be done to secure the future if Operation Summer Rain succeeds. What does Israel need to do in Gaza and West Bank and the southern portion of Lebanon, south of the Litani River, to avoid this happening again if they're successful in this mission?
Okay. Well, naturally, over the airwaves, I'm not going to give out any...
clearly, in general terms.
...information, but obviously the main problem here is the subject of deterrence. Israel needs to get... to have its deterrent possibility restored. We were greatly misunderstood by the Hezbollah in October 2000 when we pulled out of Lebanon. And we pulled out of Lebanon not out of weakness, but out of strength and out of the belief that if we solve the differences between the two parties, all sides will be able to get down and get on and get back to their lives. Unfortunately, this was greatly misunderstood
as weakness.
As a weakness on the part of Israel. And instead of taking the opportunity to take advantage of this this situation and start developing peace and prosperity, in fact, they used the period to build up their arms. And in fact, during this period, from October 2000 till today, there were over 33 attacks launched against Israel by the unprovoked by the Hezbollah from the north.
Very, very briefly, I want and in Gaza the same. It was an the argument we made, it was perceived as weakness. Israel pulls out unilaterally. Sharon takes a lot of heat for it, and 1,000 Qassam missiles are launched.
Exactly. And
besides the security on the ground, David, there's been a lot of discussion that Israel lost a lot of intelligence assets by pulling out of Gaza and then couldn't protect itself from the Keren Shalom attacks. Is that a consideration going forward?
Well, I think when you look at the successes that we're having on the ground, I think you can see that the Israeli security agency, which is responsible for this this domain, has been having a lot of successes. You note some of the attacks that are taking place and the effectiveness of our operations. I don't think you'll find that we have a problem with intelligence in that part.
David Harrell, thank you very much for taking the time. Montreal, we're out of time, but just remember, this is a fight for all the free world. Liberty demands responsibility. That's why so many dread it. We've shown you today people from Los Angeles to New Delhi who don't dread it, who take responsibility for liberty, and thankfully our country does as well. Thank you to Chris Smith. Thank you to our producer, Val Prudnikoff. We'll see you next time.